Morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order February 5th, 2021. With me today is Co-Chair Senator Bishop, Senator Von Imhoff, calling in Senator Olson, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Wilson, Senator Hoffman, myself, Stedman. We have a full contingent today. We are going to talk about the retirement system today and the FY22 state contribution suggested in the budget documents. So we've got online the Director of the Division of Retirement Benefits. And if he could introduce himself for the record, who he represents, and take us through his presentation, and please have a brief stall at the end of the slides in case the committee members have questions, and I'll cue it up for the next slide after that, and we'll just take the issues as they come to the committee members.
Good morning, Chair Stedman, Co-Chair Bishop, and members of the committee. Thank you for inviting us today for the Alaska Public Employee Retirement System, PERS, and the Teachers Retirement System, TERS, annual update. For the record, my name is Ajay Desai, Division Director of Retirement and Benefits under the Department of Administration. I have been with the division for the past 4 years, since 2017. I bring about 32 years of experience in the pension and health benefit administration arena. With me today, I have two lifelines and subject matter experts, Chief Financial Officer Kevin Worley and Chief Health Administrator Emily Ritchie. Without further ado, we'll begin with the slide one.
Go ahead and continue. We're on slide page number two.
Okay. This slide shows the Alaska Retirement Management Board organization chart as to how the two departments cohesively work together with the Alaska Retirement Management Board, otherwise known as the ARM Board. Effective October 1, 2005, ARM Board served as a trustee for the Pension and Retiree Health Trust, the State of Alaska Supplemental Annuity Plan, and Deferred Compensation Plans. Their primary duties are to manage and invest assets in a manner that it is sufficient to meet the liabilities and pension obligations of the systems. Summary of the activity includes establishment of investment policies, review actuarial earnings assumptions, establish asset allocations, set contribution rates of employers, provide investment options, and monitor performance.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
Continue slide two, okay. Slide two is showing the membership as of June 30, 2020, under both PERS and TERS for DB and DC plans. As you can see, there are many detailed numbers by tier and by different categories, active, inactive, retired, under both DB versus DC plans. And if you pay attention to the last column on the color numbers, which is it shows under DB plan, we have about 34% active participants still as of 2020. Inactive vested are about 71%. Retired at 100%, and under DC plan, active population is about 66%, is continuously growing, and inactive vested are about at 29%, and DC retirees, so 0%, although there are retirees in there, but because of the point, less than point or half percent, it shows zero.
You can tell me when you're finished with your slide, so I make sure that I understand that you're not just taking a breath or thinking about a concept.
Thank you, sir. I'm done with this slide, so for the next slide.
Okay, do we have any questions on slide number three? Okay, next slide, please.
(Clears So before we dive a little bit deeper into the PERS interest, I just wanted to bring a status update on the Employer Group Waiver Plan, otherwise known as the EGWP subsidy. As I reported last year, for 2019, actual subsidy is now about $49.5 million compared to the projected subsidy of $52.9. I reported about $52.9 last year. This slide shows 49.5 for 2019. That's an actual number. We're almost actual number for 2020 at 58.38, subject to minor adjustment due to true-up. That will continue until June of this year. And we are projecting about 62.25 for 2021, which is now trending higher than what we expected. So we believe that, this will tremendously help towards the OPEB liability. Any questions on this slide?
Yes, Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So when you say subsidy, this is a UGF, this is a general fund additional payment to the tune of, for 2021, 62,000? 60, what is this? 62 million. 62 million. So,
62 million.
And this is a subsidy that the general fund has to pay to make this whole?
Through Chair, Senator Von Imhoff, these are the actual savings that otherwise we would have spent that money for the drugs under the retiree plan. So by implementing EGWP, we are now able to save and get a subsidy from the federal to reduce our costs. That eventually helps towards the additional state contributions. Emily, would you like to add some more?
Could I follow up, Senator?
Yes.
So this is, so I'm remembering now, so this is prescription drugs, like a plan sort of, or it's like a reorganization to help do bulk purchasing with prescription drugs, and you're saying that the federal government is going to be paying the state of Alaska $62 million projected for 2021 as a savings, as a cost shift from the state to the feds?
Yes, that is correct. Through Chair, Senator Von Imhoff, that is absolutely correct.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Another question on the slide. Senator Wilson.
Yes, thank you. What are the projections going forth in terms of the cost savings? So what year will these cost savings sort of plateau and end?
Emily, could you please handle this?
We have a question from Senator Wilson wanting to know when these cost savings are going to be in effect.
Yes, I would like to have Emily Ritchie on the line step in to provide more detailed answer. Emily, are you available?
Through the chair, good morning, Senator Wilson. My name is Emily Ritchie. I'm the Chief Health Administrator in the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And Senator Wilson, the federal subsidies that are provided through the Employer Group Waiver Plan are fairly dynamic when you look at the catastrophic reinsurance and the coverage gap discount. And those reflect the pharmacy spending for our membership. So if you notice 2019 through 2021, they grow. Part of that is because the prescription drug costs for our retiree members is growing at that same time period. So for the foreseeable future, assuming that there are no changes at the federal level in these subsidy levels, as prescription drug costs increase, those subsidies are anticipated to increase as well.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions on slide number 4? Okay, next slide, please.
Okay, moving on to slide number 5. This slide shows the additional state contribution projected from 2022 through 2043 now. As you can see, we have now a little bit more going towards after 2039, as we originally assumed that by 2039 we will be 100% funded. But as we created the multiple, layer, 25 years layer for the new liabilities, on the TERS side, there are slightly higher number. The contribution rate goes a little bit higher than 12.56. As a result, that amount will be still continue to be paid by the additional state assistance. And we will continue to see, or maybe dilute by next year. So this number will fluctuate as we go along. But majorityly, the state assistance will continue to pay on the higher number by 2039.
And can you give us an estimate?
Questions on this slide?
Can you give us an estimate on, there's always a concern that there'd be a big chunk of cash at the end and not very many participants. Has that been, what's the status, current status and thinking of that in the outlook in 2040?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, that was the reason that we extended this under the, the statute that allowed us to extend this 25 layers amortization beyond 2039. So in case, let's say 2038 or 2039, if there is a significant drop in investment income, that would not be a huge liability in a 1 year to pay off additional state contributions. So this mechanism allows us to continue to pay beyond 2039 in a very small amount, as the majority of the contribution, state contribution, will be paid by 2039. By these numbers, we do not anticipate that this number will be hugely large as we are paying today.
Okay, and just for a reference, what's the unfunded liability of both PERS and TERS today?
Today, if we were to pay it in a present value, that would be about a little bit over $6.1 billion. It will show in the later for the slides, a few slides as we go along.
Right. Could you please repeat that? I didn't get that numeric.
That number would be about $6.1 billion in a present value. If we were to pay off their liability today in a one lump sum, that would be about $4.8 billion for PERS and about $1.4 billion for TERS.
Okay, thank you. Okay, go ahead and continue.
Okay, slide number six. It shows the additional state contributions to date. It's a history to date since 2006 through 2021, how much state has contributed towards PERS and TERS unfunded liability. And total adds up by both about nearly $8 billion, 7.9. And that's a significant amount that supports the pension unfunded liability. As you can see in the same slide, it shows $3 billion that was paid in 2015. $1 billion was under PERS and $2 billion went under TERS.
Correct. Do we have any questions on this? I'd just like to point out that when we reduced our contribution in 2016, 17, 18, and 19, it just comes back to bite us. We end up paying more later, so we want to be cognizant of that when a lot of states are skipping or substantially reducing their unfunded liability payments. That's not necessarily a good idea. You're just making the matters worse in the future. Go ahead and continue.
Okay, continuing on slide number seven. Slide number seven shows investment experience for 2019. As of June 30, 2019, actual report. The first column shows assume actual earning rate that is set by the board at about 7.38% for PERS and TERS. In 2019, the PERS fair market value asset return was about 6%. For TERS, it was 5.9%. And for 2020, that's a draft number yet. It has not been finalized. It shows 4.1% and for the both. Similarly, if you look at for the actuarial value perspective, that would be 5.5% on the both for 2019 and a little bit higher for 2020, 5.8%.
So explain the issue with when the assumed actuarial earnings rate is 7.3 or 7.4 in your fair value and your assets is down at 4.
Correct. So the true the fair value assets are actual return from the market. However, when actuary determines and use those rates for the valuation perspective, they smooth it out and they only they spread it out over a 5 years period. What it means that as it recognized 20% of the investment gain or loss each year, so it doesn't directly take 4.10% for 2019, as it may have adjustment coming from past 4 years. As a result, the difference between 4.1 and 5.8 shows that smoothing method and mechanism. So by applying this method, it impacts very less. There is no dramatic impact on the actuarial asset of the plan.
Here we go. Another question in a minute, but so are you hitting your targeted rates of return, and is your target rates of return, should we expect them to be decreased from your consultants coming here shortly?
For obviously, by looking at this one, 2020, our expected return was 7.38, and actuarial perspective, we are a little bit below, it shows 5.8. Obviously, trend will show last year was pretty tough, and not just US-wide, worldwide, actually. We'll have to see yet exactly how the return brings in for the next year and what this percentage would be by averaging and smoothing method.
Yeah, I'm having a hard time understanding the vibrations of the speaker in my old ears. So if you could help me again. The expected rate of return of the portfolio is higher than the actual return levels, and I want you to address that. And then, what should we expect from Cowen on future rates of return and future inflation targets going forward? Because clearly, we've been cautioned by the permanent fund yesterday; those rates are coming down. What are you hearing?
That is correct, Chair Steadman. I would invite our subject matter expert, Kevin Worley, to speak about it.
That'd be fine. Mr. Worley, if you can identify yourself for the record, who you represent, and help the committee.
Hi, good morning. This is Kevin Worley, Chief Financial Officer for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. Your question regarding the interest rates, where our actuarial assumed rate of return is 7.38%, and looking at that, we have an experience study which is done every 4 years, and this four-year period actually ends on June 30, 2021, and our consulting actuary, Buck, will be looking at what our actuarial assumptions are, and rate of return is one of them, compared to what we've actually experienced, so the rates of return over the last 4 years, and working with Department of Revenue and Cowen and Associates for future rates of return. That'll be discussed over the next year.
Okay.
So we'll be looking at that rate of return experience and assumed during this next study.
So let me rephrase my question. During the last fiscal year, what was your target and what was your return?
Target was 7.38. Return was 4.1.
Okay. So that you fell short of the target. Is that a correct interpretation of that?
That is correct.
Okay. So just be clear with the committee. We want to keep things straight up so the public can understand it. Some years we expect you to be over, and some years under. We don't expect you to hit your target. So, but I want the committee members and other folks to understand what we're talking about here. So what you're telling us is that you're going to have a review from the actuaries and the consultants coming in the summer sometime, and the information then won't be back to this finance committee till next January?
This is Kevin Worley again. The experience study will actually start this summer. It usually takes about a year to perform that study and then work it through the actuarial committee of the ARM board, as well as getting adopted by the ARM board. So it will be in the June 30, 2021 valuation reports issued summer of 2022.
Okay, so if I could follow up with that, if the presentation or the expectations, I should say, not the presentation, but the expectations that were delivered on the capital markets to the permanent fund and then relayed to this committee yesterday of lower growth in the financial markets over the next decade, we should be expecting lower rates of return, we should be prepared then at this table for a potential request for a higher contribution rate?
To the chair, this is Kevin Worley, Chief Financial Officer. During the course of the meetings that we have with the actuarial committee, with our actuarial consultants, and with Callan and Department of Revenue, we'll have to work that out. Keep in mind that our investing time perspective is different than the permanent fund corporations. So I believe the projections for the permanent fund are based on a much shorter time frame than they are for the retirement systems.
Right, but they're still invested in the equities markets in the U.S. and the bond markets in the U.S., and you're not going to be able to avoid a lot of that. So I recognize there's some different time frame issues, but the concern here is cash flow to the state, where other states around the nation are cutting, from my understanding, is cutting their contributions to the unfunded liabilities, therefore pushing that issue forward and making it worse. I don't think it's in the best interest of the state to do that. And my concern here is if we're going to have a risk of a higher capital call in the Treasury the next couple of years, the sooner we know about it, the better, because we're trying to lay out a path to get us out of this financial mess. So if you could help the Finance Committee with some rough estimates of what you think is coming, I don't want to sit here in a year to wait for an answer. You know, we don't have an infinite supply of cash. So we just want to be able to factor that stuff in, and we don't expect extreme accuracy in the numbers, but you should be able to ballpark, give us a general rule of thumb what we can expect, so we can factor that in these discussions and put a finer point on it next year when you get us some more definitive numerics. That's the concern. So, and we'll have Callan in front of us at some point dealing with the permanent fund and possibly with the presenters issue later on, because there is definite concern on changing capital market expectations to a lower level when we're in kind of a tough spot financially to maneuver, and getting tougher every year. So we have another question. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So really appreciate the slide, and thank you for providing the three different rates. I did see, though, beginning in 2015, the valuation method recognizes the 20% of the investment gains. So we have on this slide 2019-2020. I do see jumping ahead in slide 11, you've provided, a much longer history. But I think for this particular slide, having the three rates, if it's possible, from 2015 through 2020, to at least see a trend and to see a difference of what actuals, assumed actuarial earnings rate, and what the differences are with base fair market assets, I think that will give us a little bit of an idea of whether we're making our mark or not. because it does, when you look at subsequent slides here, whether we have an effective funding ratio depends on whether our coverage is adequate, because if we're not, if our rates are 4.1 versus 7.38, we're not funding it adequately. And then lastly, just to dovetail with Senator Stedman's recommendation, similar to what the DNR does for oil forecasts, is they have a small, medium, and low, or high, medium, and low, and perhaps something along that line for what the next 10 years of high, medium, and low may look like, depending on what the rates of return may be, I think will give us a better idea. And that just should be just be an ongoing slide, Mr. Chairman, that we can have, and we can have basically more sooner than next June.
Right. I think they call those a bugle graph. And they can be put in dollars and percentages.
Absolutely.
And it is surprising when you look at the dollar spread on when you do that type of analysis. You can really get a feel for your risk level, if it's a tighter range or a real broad range.
So in summary, Mr. Chairman, if we could restate this particular slide 7 to have 2015 through 2020 with the three different rates would be helpful, I think.
Okay, so if the chief financial officer could help us with that, or help Ledge Finance with that when they put in the inquiry to you, we'll see if we can't come up with a better feel. This is a significant cash call on the Treasury, 300 and some million. So we want the better we can, and tighter we can get our expectations, the more accurate path we're going to be able to put forward to get us out of this mess.
Right.
I'm not talking about the mess with the pension plan. I'm talking about the mess with the structural deficit. Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Just a comment. It's not a question. You can go back to 2015, two slides back. We don't have to go there. You made inference of the $300 million deposits going forward. If we hadn't made the 2015 deposits, we'd be looking north of $1 billion a year deposits going forward right now. So this table and the legislature needs to be commended for that deposit. So, but we just want to make sure, I think the theme here you're hearing is we want to make sure that we don't get in that same situation going forward as the cash tightens up.
Correct. So, any other questions on page 7?
To the chair.
Yes.
This is Kevin Worley, chief financial officer. So in response to Senator Von Emmott's request, we will provide 2015 to 2020 information as noted on slide 7, and we will work with Department of Revenue since they do all the investing for the system. So I'll reach out to Department of Revenue for that.
Okay, that would be appreciated, because we're not it's not just the folks with PERS and TERS that we're asking these questions to. It's across the board. So don't think that you're in anybody's gun sights here.
Right.
We want to make darn sure we don't underfund this obligation and make it worse is what we're concerned about. Okay, we'll go on to slide 8.
Okay, thank you, Chair Stedman. For the record, this is again Ajay Desai, Division Director. The slide number 8 shows the funded status as of June 2018, and also shows a draft up to for the 2020. And this slide shows actually the total overall status. If you notice on the middle line, actual funded ratio highlighted for the last value, as the last valuation report is about 78.4, and for 2020, which is still in a draft, not approved by the ARM board, or finalized it, this number, there's a 79.3 for PERS. And similarly for TERS, that number is 85.9%, nearly 86%. And for 2020, we are assuming this number is going to go up to 86.6.
Okay. Go ahead. Next slide, please.
Yes, the next slide is a breakdown between pension, defined benefit pension, and for the next slide would be after the health plan. So under defined benefit pension plan, Similarly, the 2019 ratios, funded ratios, so 63.7 in middle column, and expected one for 2020 is about 63.6, slightly lower. Similarly, for TERS is 75.3 as of the last valuation, and for a draft 2020, so 75.0.
Okay. Next slide.
Moving on to slide number 10. This one shows for the health benefit plan, which is a healthcare. 2019 shows 109.2% funded ratio, and 2020 is expected to be 113.5. Under TERS, similarly, about 117% for 2019, and for 2020, that number will go up to 121.3.
Okay, so on that issue, and we've talked about this before, but help us and remind us again, understanding this mechanism where we have overfunding in the healthcare here forecasted to be at 118%, while we're a little lower than we'd like, not in an alarming spot, but we're a little lower than we'd like on the pension side. Can you help us on understanding that?
Yes, Chair Sedman. I would again invite Chief Financial Officer Kevin Worley to provide more details about this funded ratio. Okay. Kevin?
Good morning. Kevin Worley, Chief Financial Officer for Retirement and Benefits. The funding for the health plan, we're currently depositing what is called the normal cost or the annual cost to fund the health care plan. We also have, because it's overfunded, we would have what is normally considered a negative past service cost, which could reduce the contributions going into the health care trust. But because of statutes that we have in place, we're not allowed to take a negative past service cost or a reduction to the contribution percentage rate for health care. So, and that was as a result of the situation that we encountered about 20 years ago. So we will be continuing or requesting employers to make a contribution rate into the health care plan even though we're overfunded.
Okay. We've got a couple questions here, but just as a further definition, I think we've talked about this issue. At what point does this funding level get so much higher than need be that we'd want to go back and revisit that statute to direct more of those payments into the pension?
Yes, sir.
That's a question.
Oh.
At what point should we revisit that and rebalance that so some of the cash flow going to the overfunded position mm-hmm. in healthcare to the underfunded position in the pension plan?
All right. Kevin Worley, Chief Financial Officer. That is something we have discussed internally. The way the way the statutes are currently written, we can't do that. We would like to look at ways to better fund the pension plan since we're, at the roughly 70% rate, and we are very well funded in the health trust. That would be something we could work with the ARM Board and Department of Revenue on and work with the legislative body about.
That would be my recommendation when you have time to do that, Senator Wilson and Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Chair. You asked my question for me. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Von Imhoff.
So the question is if you look to the previous slides, there's, 20,000 Tier 1 retirees. Are we overfunded because these Tier 1 retirees are very, very healthy, or they're just not, making claims on this, or why, and how quickly can it change?
Through Chair, this is Ajay Desai for the record. Through Chair, Senator Von Imhoff. For actually providing more detail on that one, I would invite Emily Ritchie, Chief Health Administrator to give you more depth behind these numbers. Ms. Ritchie?
Through the chair, for the record, this is Emily Ritchie, Chief Health Administrator in the Division of Retirement and Benefits. So the funding levels for the defined benefit health care plan were really positively impacted by the implementation of the federal subsidies we talked about in earlier slides, the employer group waiver plan. Health care costs can change fairly dramatically. While we have seen initial relief from the implementation of EGWP that is much needed, we are also seeing very dramatic cost increases, especially related to specialty drugs and new gene therapies on the pharmacy side. So, I view these numbers very positively, but I'm always cautious because healthcare costs can creep up very, very quickly in this population. Another contributor to the positive funding status is the increasing age of our retirees, which is a little counterintuitive. However, when retirees become Medicare age eligible, Medicare becomes the primary payer and the Alaska Care Health Plan becomes a secondary payer, and that has a tremendous positive impact on the cost to the retirement system. And we've seen a pretty significant increase over the last, 3 to 5 years. Looking at our quarterly report just yesterday, we saw about a 7% increase in the membership that was moving from being under the age of 65 to the age of 65 on an annual basis. So we are seeing both a reduction in the pharmacy costs associated with the federal subsidies, as well as an increase in the percentage of members that are Medicare age eligible. So I don't know if that directly answers your question regarding projections for the future. I would say that we're always watching this, and there may be changes in the healthcare system that add additional costs to the plan, but we're trying to manage this as efficiently as possible.
Follow up?
Yes. Thank you, Emily. That was actually really helpful. I assume that you track, and is that information that you could share with this committee in terms of the demographics of the 22,000 people, as in how many people are age 40 to 50, how many people are 50 to 60, 60 to 70, things of that nature, or maybe even doing it in five-year increments because it seems to be 65 is the magic age for Medicare to take over. Is that something that you can share with the committee just so we can estimate the population bell curve as they move?
Through the chair, Senator Bonnie Moss, we can do that. We can follow up with that information. Thank you.
Just note that Senator Von Imhoff was looking at the chairman when she mentioned 65 joining the Over the Hill gang. Anyway, we'll go on to the next slide.
All right. Thank you. For the record, this is Ajay Desai, Division Director of Retirement and Benefits. We are on slide number 11, which shows the historical rate of return and funded ratio side by side. So this shows from 96, which is going too far in far back, and numbers are keep getting smaller and smaller as we are adding more years into it. But important, number slide, it shows kind of numbers in red, again, in 2001 and 2002, as we had the lower return, funded ratio also drop, especially for 2001 and 2002. There was also another major factor, as Chair Stedman explained last year's presentation. However, continue further, if you look at 2008 and 2009, kind of that trend continues. When we have negative returns, it does impact our actuarially funded ratio, as you can see on the both plans. Any questions on the slide?
I don't see any questions, but it is nice to see the funded ratio advancing when we get a multi-year layout. And just as a reminder, take the early years of 96 through 01 with a grain of salt, as I don't think those are accurate funding numbers and percentages. That's why we had to do some defensive maneuvers in the pension plan to make sure it stays solvent.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the second column, the assumed actuarial earnings rate, is that the assumed rate for both of the funds, the PERS and the TERS?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, yes, that is correct. That is combined for both. Pretty much historically, the rate, assumed actual earning rate for the both plans has been set the same. It hasn't been changed so far, even until the last actuarial study that was done in 2018 and 19.
So the question that I have is, if the rate is the same for PERS and TERS, they must be invested differently, because the actual rate of return, if they're invested the same, would be the return would be the same, but throughout the chart over the years, there have been differences in the rate of return. And why is that, and is it in fact true that they are invested differently?
Through Chair, Senator Hoffman, I would again invite our Chief Financial Officer, Kevin Worley, if he has some knowledge and can shed some light on your question. Mr. Worley?
Sure. This is Kevin Worley, Chief Financial Officer. This is generally more a question for Department of Revenue, but it has to go with the stream timing of revenues coming in. School districts generally report to us on a monthly basis, where PERS employers range from a biweekly to semi to monthly to even minor employers with some quarterly information. So I would suggest that that's a timing, but I could reach out to Department of Revenue for a response on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, if you could do that and clarify if there's any commingling on the PERS and TERS in the management of it also.
Sure. Will do. Thank you.
The next slide, please.
This is Ajay Desai for the record. Slide number 12 shows the funded ratio history, again in the chart format, for both PERS and TERS from 2001 through the last valuation, completed valuation 2019.
Okay,
it's just a visual.
Any
questions on this slide?
Right. Looks like the last time we made any real gain is when we did that infusion.
Yes, sir.
Okay, next slide, please.
Slide number 13 is unfunded liability, where we stand today for PERS and TERS. It shows from 2006 all the way to 2019, last valuation date, as you asked this question earlier. This slide shows in the last column, the PERS unfunded liabilities present value is about $4.8 billion, and for TERS is nearly $1.4 billion. So it's nearly about $6.2 billion rather than $6.1 that I quoted earlier because of the rounding. So about $6.2 billion approximately is the present value of the unfunded liability. Any questions on the slide?
Yeah, in 2008 to 19, the PERS is about the same unfunded liability dollars, and TERS is significantly improved by $1.3 billion. Do you want to help the committee with that on the contribution issue?
Chair Stedman, yes, please. Again, I would invite, as history perspective, I would invite Chief Financial Officer Kevin Worley, as I'm only able to cannot go beyond 2017 as far as my knowledge. But as you can see it, all I can add into by looking at the slide, there was significant increase in 12 and 13 that went the unfunded liability all the way up to 7.8. So if you were to look at count from 2008, 4.8, and again today is around the same number, 4.8, it did go through very, almost doubling that number, nearly doubling the number, and came back down to that number. So there is a significant change and movement in the PERS that I can see it. Comparatively in TERS, yes, I agree with you, it does have a similar trend as well as PERS, but the number-wise, pretty much they're kind of going side by side as it grown from 2008 to 2012 and 13 versus where we are today in 2019.
Yeah, I still don't
Mr.
quite
Wally,
understand that.
Would you like to add any comments on this?
Yeah, I don't quite understand that. Maybe you can get back to the committee and the written answer that why we gained on the TERS and we basically didn't gain anything on the PERS from 08 to 19. I'm just kind of curious. Other questions on this slide? Okay, we'll go on to page 14.
Okay, for the record, this is Ajay Desai again. Slide number 14. This is a new slide we added last year as it kind of shows the timeline in a way that what it takes to determine the rate, annual rates for the employer's contributions and additional state contributions. So what actually looks at it is the last completed valuation, which is 2019, and they look at the asset with actual rate of return for 2020. And obviously 2021 is not completed yet. It is projected with the long-term rate 7.38. And using those numbers, FY22 employer and additional state contribution rates are determined. This is just a slide to help to understand exactly what it takes to how far do we go back. When we talk a lot about roll forward 2 years for the liability and roll forward 1 year for the assets. So this slide is trying to kind of explain that process.
Right, the delayed impact, we struggle with that all the time. Just inherent in the structure, so.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So we're going to 15.
Moving on to slide 15. So this slide shows FY 2022 contribution rates based on the valuation as we the process we saw in a previous slide. The all employers, you know, this the rates remains the same, 6.75 for the employee, peace officer and firefighters. The first rate is 7.5, and school district alternate option is about 9.6. Similarly, for the TERS, employee contribution rate is 8.65. So both employer side, the rates are capped for PERS at 22% and TERS at 12.56%. By actuarial calculation, valuation, the rate is 30.11% for 2020, the required rate, contribution rate, and for the TERS is 31.85. And the number that shows in the middle row, additional state contribution, that is the amount that the state pays towards the unfunded liability for the contributions for the PERS and TERS, both plans. As you can see, the PERS is about 8.11% and TERS is 19.29%.
Senator von Imhoff.
So, Mr. Chairman, I don't know when it's appropriate to ask about then, if at all, the bill, Senate Bill 55, that pertains to public employees' retirement system payments that the governor has dropped in regards to adjusting this.
Well, I think we should address that when we have the bill up.
Okay.
You know, just do the background. We can go into more detail of this subject on the contributions at that time.
Okay. It is important to note at least that this bill is coming up, right, and it is addressing contribution rates and funding sources.
Right.
Thank
we'll
you.
Have that in front of the committee when we have it in front of the committee here in the next month or so.
Okay.
Senator Milikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just curious, the latest federal bill that's going through Congress, I think it's $1.9 trillion. I'm just curious if there's any federal relief that could be applied to our defined benefit plans in that bill, if you're monitoring that at all.
Okay. Could you help us with that? If you guys have and the departments have heard if there's any potential relief for unfunded pension liabilities for the states coming out of Washington's new COVID bill?
Through Chair, Senator Wilikowski, at this point, the bill is still in a draft stage, and we do not have as much detail as how and which way it will impact. We continue to work with the appropriate entity, actually, to analyze this bill and help through this process. But at this point, it would be too early to provide any details, as we are not much involved that how will it impact. We know that it's coming, and as you mentioned, Chair Stedman, it's absolutely true. We don't have as much detail that, you know, we can surely answer this question.
Senator Wilikowski.
Just a request for the Chair, Mr. Chairman. My understanding is that bill contains pretty significant relief for states. I don't know if it's pension relief or not, but I'd be certainly interested in some point in the near future getting some kind of update from the administration on what they anticipate, because I think that could have huge impact on preparation of our budget. Thank you.
Right, and just to help Wilikowski with that question, we will be having Ledge Finance work on that piece of legislation in D.C. once it's firmed up, and then I'm sure the administration will be doing the same, and we'll be working together so we can take advantage of that in the budget process to try to make our ends meet. So we'll be looking at it. In fact, we'll be scrubbing for any nickel in it we can get for the state. Okay, next page, please.
Oh, wait, thank you, Chair Stedman.
You can hold up there for a second.
We have the record. This is Ajay Desai. The page number 16 shows, again, same 2022 contribution rates for the DC plan. And under this slide, it shows for DC plan, employees under PERS contributes about 8%, and TERS 8%. Employer pays 5% for the PERS and 7% for TERS. The healthcare percentage for PERS is 1.07%, and for TERS is 0.83%. Occupational death and disability for all employees are about 0.31%, and for peace officer firefighter is 0.68%, and for the TERS, it's 0.08%. And health reimbursement account is about, it's a flat dollar that is calculated based on 3% of all PERS and TERS average annual compensation. And any overflow that goes beyond this contributions are made under the employee's account, that helps towards the DB plan's unfunded liability.
So we have a question, I think, on the previous slide. You know, you want to pass on that? Okay, do you have a question on this current slide?
I do.
Okay, we have a question from Senator Wilson on page 16.
It's not really on 16, Chairman, but just wondering how Alaska compares to other states in regards to the unfunded liability to see where we're sort of averaging throughout our other states.
That's a broad question, but we could throw it to them if they can give us a brief synopsis of where the state faces relative to other states on the unfunded liability issue.
So, Chair, Senator, yes, we can get that information. We do participate with the NASRA, which is a national organization that we provide information about our plan, and we also be able to get the information for the other plans as well. We will reach out to them and get the most latest information and follow through.
If you can get that to the committee, and be sure you add in the health care that we don't end up counting our health care that we have funded in the states, other states, just their pension and not their health care, so we're seeing both on both issues. That would be appreciated. Go on to page 17.
Any further questions on slide 16?
No, we're on page 17.
On page 17, again, it shows kind of graphically the difference between the flat 22% on the top chart versus the additional state contributions that state has paid through from 2008 through 2020. as the chart fluctuates up and down, the middle area kind of shows the number between the two required percentage of the contribution. As you can see in 2014, the required the employer contribution was flat at 22%, but the actuarial rate was 31.9%. So the gap between those two was paid by the state as additional state contributions. So similarly for the TERS, this chart simply shows the graphical gap between those required contributions versus the cap.
We have a question from Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. And just curious, are we still the only state in the country that doesn't have a defined benefit plan for state employees or Social Security?
Through the chair, Senator, I believe there are a couple other states who have stopped providing the DB benefits. At this point, I don't have exact information on that. We'll get back to you and follow through for good information.
If you can get back to the committee on that, and just as a note on TERS not being in Social Security, they can opt into Social Security if they choose. That's not something we control. Senator Wilikowski.
You sort of read my mind there, Mr. Chair. Has there been any discussion about having PERS or TERS, to your knowledge, opt back into Social Security?
Through the chair, Senator, no, I haven't heard any. I know that there have been questions about the TERS. How can they get back under the Social Security? And we have provided many information as best as we could. But as Chair Stedman said, there is an option to opt into the Social Security. As far as PERS, we don't have any other information or anything about it.
Thank you. And we have Senator Von Imhoff and Senator Wilson.
Essentially, I was just going to say thank you, Mr. Chairman, is that there is always that option, and it's up to each individual groups to meet and vote, and they need a majority vote in order to opt back in, and that's entirely up to them. And I think it's separate from state statute. We are, as legislators, are not in control of that.
Okay. Okay, go on to the next slide, please. Slide number 18.
Slide number 18. It shows the projected pension benefit recipients, the count of the retirees who are currently receiving benefits from the system. And as you can see it on the top line of the chart, it shows the total number, about 51,639 retirees will be receiving benefit from PERS and TERS. Similarly, number shows separately for PERS and TERS under blue line and green line, respectively. And according to the latest valuation report, we show in 2029, we will have the highest population receiving the pension benefit from the both plans. That will reach around about 58,000 retirees.
Okay. And just for those listening at home, just as a reminder, we are in no jeopardy whatsoever of not meeting our pension obligations, none. So what we're talking about here today with the unfunded liability is a cash flow issue that the state faces as we go forward, and in no way is the retirees subjected to any adverse cash position within the retirement plan or our ability not to fund it to keep the retirement checks coming. So as a reminder, because sometimes the meetings are misinterpreted, when the concern we have with the unfunded liability versus the ability we have to pay our obligations. They're two different things. We have any questions on slide 18? Slide number 19.
Thank you, Sir Stedman, and I echo your statement. What you mentioned is absolutely true. Slide 19 shows the projected pension benefit payments. What we will be paying for 2021, it's about 1.5 compared to that in 2036 or 2037, we will be at the peak. Paying about $2 billion for that particular year. And then after that, the chart shows kind of slowing down as retiree, passes away due to old age. But we'll continue to make the payment until the end of the century.
So can you help me?
And it goes back to
why the chart. Could you help me why the chart goes out to 2100? That's a pretty long life expectancy.
It is actually, Chair Stedman, yes, that's true. It is a kind of mathematical question that how one would live up to 2100. However, there are many retirees who have not retired yet under, I mean, many employees who have not retired under PERS Center system yet. They are still active. And based on their age plus assumption on their benefit election, the beneficiary will continue to receive the benefit beyond their death. So this is not just a one person age that, you know, shows the chart. It shows the combined and combination of the age of the employees, beneficiaries, the disabled participants, and we believe that based on the age and service and based on the chosen benefit option, beneficiary will continue to receive this benefit beyond participant's death.
Right, and I remember struggling with that as far as passing down the benefits. Clearly your spouse, you can pass it to your spouse, but you'd have to have a spouse that's 20 years old now.
Yep. Yes, sir. It could be your children, sir, too. Yeah. So you can pass the benefit to your child. Yes. So, you know, the age, depending on the benefit option chosen, these are the projections. It's kind of steady what we have seen for the past few years. It fluctuates around 2100. One I have seen a couple of years ago, that projection went up to 2112 for the last person receiving the benefit. This year it shows at 2100.
So if you could help with the previous question by Senator Von Imhoff on the age distribution, I think it'd be pretty interesting to see how many, you could help us with how many qualified people are under the defined benefit plan that are, you know, 0 to 10 years old, 10 to 20, 20 to 30, whatever, all the way through, do it 5-year increments, whatever.
Yes, sir.
Senator Wilson.
Yeah, along with that, have we seen any type of trends with when someone retires until their age that they die in terms of life expectancy changes? And if so, how's that changed sort of the trends?
If you can, when you answer that question, could you please remind us about the life expectancy tables and how often those are reset? I think that's the underlying question from Senator Wilson.
Yes, through the Chair, Senator Wilson, I would like to invite again our Chief Financial Officer, Kevin Worley, to shed some lights on that question. Mr. Worley.
Hi, Kevin Worley, Chief Financial Officer. It probably suit us better if we sent over the life expectancy tables to you. But to follow up on your question, that's one of the tables that we look at during our experience study. So looking at during the 4-year period where we're comparing actual experience to assumptions. So we could see an update after this next study is performed after 2021 is complete. Okay.
And they have been continually extended out for generations. So, Senator Wilson.
Yeah, I guess that was part of the question was there is recent debate upon, well, has COVID changed that in terms of defined benefits and for Social Security on the long term? So I didn't know if that was taken a play into some new studies that were being done.
Okay. So we'll go on to slide 20, our last page, and I've just been handed a note, kind of entertaining. This FYI, the last widow of a Confederate soldier just passed away last year in the Civil War. So that's...
What?
Thank you, Chair Stedman. The slide number 20 shows health care cost trend rates based on the last actuarial valuation for 2019. And it begins with 7% for the medical pre-65. And if you see the last line, 2050 plus, beyond that, the rate will continue at 4.5% for all three, medical pre-65, medical post-65, and additional column that we added after implementing AGWIP.
Okay.
Any questions on the slide?
No question on this slide. So that concludes the slide deck. Is that correct?
That is correct, sir.
We have a question from Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The last 2 years I brought this subject up since they are included in the retirement decision-making process for individuals, that those are the SBS and the deferred comp that the department administers. Several years ago, we submitted a plan to the federal government that changed the way the whole retirement system works. And one of the concerns that I expressed and continue to have is that deferred comp is an individual decision by state employees. They look at their tax situation and decide if and when they want to change their amount and participate in the deferred comp program. The problem with the state of Alaska when they submitted their plan was that they included that in the federal plan, and individuals no longer have the luxury of deciding whether or not they want to take funds out of the deferred comp plan for tax purposes. They can only access the deferred comp funds when they retire. So the question that I have is, over the last 10 years, can you give me the number of participants in the deferred comp program and the total amount on a yearly basis of the deferred comp deductions? I'm concerned that we took, by including the deferred comp into the state's retirement program and individuals cannot access those dollars, that has taken away a management tool for those individual employees. And I would probably conclude that what benefits do people have in deferring their income if they can't access it throughout the years until they retire? So if you can get me that information, it would be greatly appreciated. I think the state of Alaska made a mistake by including that the deferred comp program into the retirement system and not allowing the individual employees to have control over the funds that are their dollars, nothing to do with the state of Alaska.
So if you could help Senator Hoffman with that question, get the data back to the committee and we'll dispense it out. It'd be nice to have a historical view of participation numbers, how many people participated in it from around the state over the last several decades, and the dollars going in, and even if you have the aggregate account balance of everything totaled. Do you have any final comments that you'd like to make to the committee before we let you off the hot seats?
To Chair Stedman, Senator Hoffman, yes, we will gather this information, and we hear you loud and clear, and I believe we have done some research on that one, but we will provide you the information that you're looking for. Also, we will try to find out the possibility in the laws, federal regulations, are there any options that allows to make any changes under this particular deferred compensation plan to help the participant withdrawing the benefits from it. So we'll definitely follow through and get back to you on that.
Final question.
Thank you, Chair Stedman.
One other request. Are any other states participating into the or treating the deferred comp program the way the state of Alaska is treating it?
Okay, if you could add that to your response, that'll be helpful so we can get a holistic view. That concludes the meeting today. I'd like to thank everybody for coming, particularly our participants today, to go over the retirement system. It's a very serious issue to the entire state, not only the participants, but the entire state. We are going to gather back up Monday morning, 9 a.m. We're going to have Senate Bill 68, which is the fiscal year 21 supplemental budget. So we're going to lay that out. Later in the week, we'll be looking at the beginning of the operating budget. We're going to take the governor's operating budget, and we're going to restate it in the format that we use. For those watching at home, some of the order of the legislation is a little different. So we will take the proposed budget with basically no changes, rearrange it into our format, and then we'll start with our stepped procedure to walk through the operating budget review and the simulation and alterations as we collectively come forward with the Senate Finance version of the operating budget. So we are going to have a busy week next week. We look forward to everybody being here. 9 a.m. Monday morning, we are adjourned.